This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and we are joined by David Winner. He is the author of a book that Fernando introduced to me and instantly became one of my all-time favorite books about soccer, Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer. And I really don't think I can convey how exceptional a work this is. It is so illuminating, not only about Dutch soccer in its development and the development of total football in the 1970s in Holland, but also just about Dutch society. It's an elliptical work. It even declares that its chapters aren't in order. It's highly impressionistic. And in being that way, it is so insightful about Dutch soccer, about soccer theory and practice in general. It's a fantastic work, and we're very honored to have David Winner on the show with us today. So welcome to The People's Game, David.
Bless you. keep going. You know, I'm not going to... I don't want to butt in.
Well, let me just say, okay, I'll take one little quote here from The Guardian. Wry, obsessional, digressive, deep. This is football as art, metaphor, cultural signifier. So let's get into it then, because one of the things, and I suppose a striking thing about the book is, let's all think right now about the Netherlands and about Holland and what we know about it and what we think we know about it. Well, first of all, Dutch football, they're one of the great world footballing countries and national sides, but they were lousy in the 50s and 60s. So it all came together in the 70s. So what can you tell us first about Dutch football in the 50s and 60s and before that?
Deeply amateurish, backwater, of no international interest to anybody at all, barely of interest to the Dutch themselves. Not a minority sport, though it had been until fairly late. Then in the 50s, what the crucial thing that happens is that amateurism, it makes a little bit of space for professionalism. At one point, there's a player called Arbe Lentstra, who's probably the best before Cruyff. He gets into trouble for being, you know, interested in money. And there's another one, Charles Wilkes, who's the boyhood hero of Cruyff. He has to go off and play in Italy. But professionalism comes, I think it's 54. And then after that, there's a development. And then it's still a bit of a backwater, though remember also clubs such as Bayern Munich, you know, Germany goes professional around about that time. And these superpower leagues that we now think of, they come to professionalism very late, much later than the Italians and Spanish, you know, decades after the British, after the English. And that's a big change. And then at Ajax, which is the main Amsterdam club, it ends up as the only Amsterdam club, in the early 60s, round about exactly the same time that the sort of hippie, what becomes the hippie movement, Amsterdam Magic Center, it becomes later. It starts off as a kind of a youth revolt. It becomes the Provo, sort of hippie, proto-hippie movement. Just as that's kicking off in Amsterdam, and Amsterdam becomes one of the centers of the sort of counterculture 60s phenomenon. Exactly the same moment, two guys come together at Ajax in what is already a club full of very technical, rather quiet, but rather technical, skillful, craft-filled players who've, in a club which has got a tradition of attacking football, even from the amateur football days of the sort of First World War and just after that era and through the interwar period. Johan Cruyff, this 17-year-old genius player, you know, comparable really only with Pelé and Maradona as the world's historic, you know, great player. And the coach, Rinus Michels, who had been a sort of a brilliant, garrulous, sort of jolly centre-forward just after the war for Ajax. He comes and he's transformed and becomes this very ambitious, very Holland's first really sort of self-taught, super clever, very ambitious, disciplined coach. And between them, they become this sort of joint catalyst for an absolute revolution. I can't think of any equivalent any place in soccer ever, where you go from being really a backwater and of no interest to anybody to being the most radical, the most interesting, the most stylish, skillful, innovative in world football in the space of sort of 6-7 years. And by the early 70s, Ajax are European champions. They've developed a new form of the game called, which the journalists call Total Football, which has two main tactical elements. It's like switching positions and rotating and being very free about playing creatively and pressing. It's now sort of these elements are sort of standard now, but it's an absolute sensation. So you press and play a very high offside line and then just spend the whole game just pouring forward and attacking, dominating, overwhelming opponents. You see it now, direct continuation, speeded up, of course, because the athletic abilities are much greater now, so it all has to be done much more quickly. But at Barcelona, that's basically what they were doing, and you see Barcelona, it takes your breath away sometimes. And that's the same kind of effect when it was invented. It was even more extraordinary. And that's basically what happened.
So Holland, also in the 1950s and 1960s, was a very conservative country. There was a social transformation around the Western world with the 1960s, early 1970s. In many respects, that took place in just a parallel way with soccer, and both of them stuck in Holland. Since that time, Holland, and particularly Amsterdam, has been thought of as one of the libertine capitals of the world, and Dutch football has remained exceptional. And, you know, there certainly are other national sides that sort of blip up with these golden generations. Hungary, of course, comes to mind from the 1950s, and then they sort of fade down and become second-rate football teams, national teams. That didn't happen with Holland. So what were the institutions in soccer that have maintained this in Holland? And then to go along with that, how significant is football in contemporary Dutch culture, you know, since the 1970s?
The short answer to the second part of that is very, and it gets bigger all the time. There was an idea lurking behind the question, which I would challenge slightly, because you know, everything is fluid, everything is changing. We're talking about the 70s, that sort of 40, the late 60s, you know, 40, 45 years ago. The soccer of that time was a product of that moment, culturally, historically, developmentally. It's, you know, Holland is not quite the same Holland as it was, and you can see a reflection of that in the football that they're playing at the moment in the World Cup, which is not, you know, the free-flowing, adorable, romantic, slightly fragile, but, you know, very inspiring, beautiful stuff that I fell in love with, but which certainly did not end up with them winning the World Cup. They're the biggest soccer country that's not won the, you know, it's only one of the great soccer powers that's not won the World Cup. You know, now you talked about it, it's a sort of libertine culture, and it was associated with a sort of very free-floating leftist, liberal kind of politics that came to dominate anyway, and it sort of broke through in the 60s. Now that's rather changed. The recent Dutch election a couple of weeks ago, there's a huge breakthrough for Geert Wilders' party, which is, you know, there's other stuff going on in it as well, but it's somewhat racist, and you know, a heavy proportion of Dutch voters voted for that. It increased its seats from, I forget the numbers, it's something like 9 to 25, something like that, in the Dutch parliament. So, and at the same time, and the parallels are never exact, and you can easily overstate them and look silly, but it's strange that Bertrand Marwijk's team is currently playing, you know, it's the exact opposite of Total Football. It's very strange. I'm having conversations all the time, and I'm puzzled, and I don't know how I feel about it, but to see Holland playing, you know, like a sort of German team, of the Germany team of the sort of 80s and 90s, or not quite in the style, but you know, defending like a classic Italian idea of how you win World Cups. You know, they're doing the minimum to get past opponents. They're revealing their skills very little. They're doing the kind of Italian thing of minimal effort, just do what it takes to get through and then wait for the next one. And the next game is Brazil, and Brazil look a much more complete and much more attractive team. And that's more or less the first time previously when Holland and Brazil have met, Holland have actually been the more skillful team and the more expressive team. And it's a very odd moment. So, you know, all these things are fluid.
institutional structure to keep Dutch football? Because, I mean, it is conspicuous.
Yeah, I mean, it got very big. It got very popular. Partly it's a kind of social and cultural thing that swept certainly the whole of Western Europe, all of Europe, and increasingly the rest of the world. As other forms of not just entertainment, but storytelling, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Film looks to a large degree predictable, and television we've got a bit bored with, and religion and old kind of political identities have faded a bit. So sports generally and soccer most of all kind of fills the vacuum, and the institutions were partly the professional clubs and the Dutch Football Association. But in Holland, it's a very clubby sort of culture, and vast numbers of people in Holland play soccer with their local club or with a club that they're a member of. And it's a game that people play at least as much as watch. And Frans Beckenbauer, the story goes that he flew over the Netherlands once and looked down and saw that there were huge numbers of soccer pitches, and he said, "Oh, that's why this little country is so good." Because it's a bit like New Zealand. I don't know if New Zealand play rugby to a phenomenal level, because they all do it. The Welsh used to be like that as well. That's basically it. It's a major sort of plank of identity and national identity as well. I think every 2 years, with occasional accidents where they don't qualify, there's this sort of giant oranging of the country. The national identity is now very, very closely tied up with football. It's something they're deeply proud of, and it's a vibrant football culture.
Speaking with David Winter, he is the author of the book Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer. It's a very conspicuous achievement, though, for the national soccer side, because everybody expects them to be, for instance, one of the top-ranked group. They get the top ranking for the group going into the World Cup, and there are eight teams that get that. And of those eight teams in this year's World Cup, Holland is more than three times smaller than the next smallest country that, again, would expect it to be there, which is Argentina. So it's a great achievement for a country of that size. Let's look a little bit at this year's team, because, they're very efficient. I would argue that they're still sort of, at least, if they're not playing total football in a creative manner, all the players out on the field, certainly, they do have the capacity to shift positions and that. I agree it's not a particularly magical side. And, as they head into Brazil, the only reason I would really give them a chance is simply because of how spectacular Ian Robin has been over the past 4 months.
Yeah, I agree with that. Alien Robin, though, we're calling him on Italian telly.
Why is that?
Well, just like he's a creature from outer space.
He has the most phenomenal. Has the most peculiar way of moving around when he doesn't have the ball and when he scores goals.
He looks like an old man with severe arthritis.
Right, right. Well, yeah, very pink.
He's going to run for a bus, you think he'd fall over, and you'd go and have to pick him up or something. And then the ball comes towards him, and he's transformed into Usain Bolt with, the most delicate touch.
Well,
it's amazing.
But
he's thrilling. And he also did something that moved me very much today. The cameras, traditionally the Dutch, when the national anthem comes at the beginning of the game, the Dutch, all the old sort of the 70s guys and the 80s guys especially, would just kind of look bored and stare into space and chew gum and kind of not be interested in any way. And Arjen Robben today his eyes were closed. He was singing the anthem. He very nearly didn't play in this World Cup. There's the last couple of minutes of a warm-up game where the Dutch looked spectacular. It was the day they flew down to South Africa, actually. They played in the afternoon, and then that evening they went to the airport. But in the last 5 minutes of the game, Arjen Robben, 6-1 up, he attempts a ridiculous showing off, little back heel, and injures himself. And the whole team was in tears. The whole stadium was shocked. And it looked very much as if the best Dutch player in a long time, one of the absolute greats of world football at the moment, the season he had with Bayern Munich was unbelievable.
Right.
Looked like he'd crocked himself. looked like he just, and he stared into the abyss and thought, I'm not going to make it. And then he worked with this fabulous therapist called Dick Van Toorn, who's kind of got him better, and he's now fit to face Brazil. So he's there, and he doesn't. One of the things that is distinguished or marked in a mark of Kane way, the Dutch teams of the past, they've been very. They've first of all not taken their own sort of brilliance seriously, and then they've undermined it by, you know, not taking opponents seriously, you know, talking about anything but football, being very unprofessional very often. And here at last, he's got a fabulous, talented player, completely devoted to his craft and to the honour, really, of playing in a World Cup. It's very moving to see him.
So what do you make of the team then? They were able in their last warm-up to play a very free-flowing, beautiful form of Dutch total football, and yet they've gotten into the tournament and they've sort of played more conservatively.
Coming to this tournament with a completely different frame of mind to almost all their previous ones, they've come to win. And oddly, they've never actually done that before, even in 74, which was the best team. They had a kind of funny mixture of certainty that they were the best, which they were, and insecurity about, well, you know, we're just a little country, and we've never been in a World Cup before. That was their first major World Cup. They played in the 30s, but in the modern era, this was the first time. And they somehow, there was a combination of sort of superiority-inferiority complex, which I think accounts for some of the disasters that they would bring on themselves. This time is different to all the other times because they've come to win. And they say, you know, they've looked at all their failures. There's a chapter in the book actually called Death Wish about the extraordinary ways in which the Dutch have managed to find ways to defeat themselves most of the time. And they would nearly always go into tournaments with the best collection of players, or at least the equal best. I mean, in 1990, for example, they had a phenomenal collection of players. Mm-hmm. There was Hullet, Rijkaard, Van Basten, Koeman, Wouters, even the defense was good, which it isn't always. And they went home without winning a single game. They couldn't even beat Egypt because they were arguing amongst themselves. They didn't want the coach they had. They wanted Cruyff. They wanted more money. No, it wasn't more money actually that time. It was status. It was the team divided into sort of three cliques. Players weren't talking to each other. It was just a disaster. It was like the French this time. Not quite as bad, but they didn't go on strike. But it was just horrible. And that was a team that should have walked the World Cup. And they were much better than on paper and as they were on other occasions. They were much better than everybody else. 94 in the States, they didn't bring Ruud Gullit because Ruud Gullit walked out in the last, you know, sort of few days before the plane left, over tactics or status or money. Nobody, he never really explained it. Ruud Gullit, he wasn't quite at his peak by then, but he was still a phenomenal player.
98 was an amazing team.
98, they were magnificent. Right. But here's the weird thing. They didn't think so. I did an interview with Dennis Bergkamp recently, and I asked him about, you know, one of the most painful games that I can remember, the semi-final against Brazil in 98, where Holland were the dominant team and lost on penalties, and they should have had a penalty in the last minute when Pierre van Hooijdonk was pulled down, and instead the referee yellow-carded him, thinking he'd dived, and he hadn't. He'd been pulled down, his cameras from behind the goal showed. And I asked him about that game. I said, why didn't you win that? And Bergkamp's answer was very interesting. He said, well, we never really expected to be at that level. We thought we were going to lose to Argentina in the quarterfinal, and then we suddenly found ourselves in the semi, and we sort of didn't really expect to be there. And you think, that's just mad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because that was an astonishing talented group. So they went in with a kind of losing mentality. They almost always went in with a losing mentality, and this time they've gone with, they've studied the problem. Bert van Marwijk has a different. He's not an old Ajax coach. He's not quite so associated. He was a Feyenoord man. He's not associated in the same way with this Dutch tradition, with Cruyff, with with this thing of which is a very much an Amsterdam thing. You bluff, you look good, you kind of, it's like a capital city pretty much anywhere, or the big city thing. You kind of look good, and that's, and being stylish is important. He's not that interested in that. I mean, he's part of the Dutch tradition, but his main thing is like, we win, that's all. And he studied it, he's decided that the most important thing is to play. You don't exhaust yourself by looking good in the early rounds in matches which don't ultimately count, as happened at the last Euros when they beat Italy and France, bumped them, disposed of Romania very easily, and then crashed out in the most feeble manner in the quarterfinal game against Russia. He says, we're not doing that this time. We'll be boring if necessary. We'll just get the points. We'll come through the early rounds, and then we'll play, you know, whatever it takes to get through. It's completely new for the Dutch. Well, I don't know how I feel about it. You know, it would be quite miserable if they play like this in a sort of defensive way, counter-attacking way, rather cagey fashion, and then go out to Brazil after, you know, that would feel very sad. On the other hand, if they beat Brazil, and then I think they'd go on to the final, you know, I wouldn't complain for a moment.
Right.
And there's this debate is happening in Holland right now. They're thinking, you know, is this really what we want, to play like an old Germany team? Because the Germans this time are much more attractive than the Dutch. It changes. There's a big argument about that in Holland at the moment. As long as he keeps winning, you know, it's not going to be a problem. But if they come home after a not good performance against Brazil, people will be quite unhappy.
It is perceived that teams like FC Barcelona, or even the Dutch national team, where it's perceived that it's more important to play well than to actually win. Can you just explain what exactly happened to the players? Is it just the new generation? Or what happened to the coaching staff? Or what happened to this mentality that made them actually want to win this time?
First of all, I mean, all the teams that you can say that's what they ended up doing would deny that that's what they wanted. Because Cruyff, for instance, always says, you do both. You win by being so good, and that involves being beautiful, fine. But the point is to win and, you know, do the things you do best. And we do attacking and creativity. That's what we do best. So he says there's no contradiction.
Right.
But in practice, because it's always hard, it's a bit like Arsene Wenger. Arsene Wenger is a kind of disciple of Cruyff. Pep Guardiola at Barcelona is a complete disciple of Cruyff.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up, you know, because it's, and so is Van Gaal, though he wouldn't admit it. You know, it's absolutely in that line.
Mm-hmm.
They would never admit it, but it is, because it's harder. The philosophical, moral arguments almost with Wenger sticks to his principles, and the principles are that you play attractive, which is more complicated. Van Gaal plays more attractive.
Mm-hmm.
He's transformed Bayern Munich last season. It's not that they've rejected those values. I think it's just that they've just looked at their history and thought, this is ridiculous that we've never won it. And we're going to go and we're going to try and win it. In mm-hmm. fact, they don't say we're going to try and win it, because that's what they would used to say. They've all said, it's like they're reading from the script, we are here to win it. And what's odd about that is that it's not by any means the most talented group of players. The defense looks weak. And in a funny way, they're playing defensively because the defense is weak. That sounds paradoxical, but because they're not completely secure. And, you know, the 90s teams played with three defenders often, and, you know, everybody else is bombing forward. And in fact, the central defender, Danny Blind or Frank de Boer, and earlier it's Ronald Koeman, and earlier it's Ruud Krol, is the central playmaker, because the passing starts and all the attacking movements start from the back with a guy with a great long ball. That's not happening this time. Matthijssen and Heitinger, they're perfectly okay, but they're not in the same mold at all as these great attacking defenders of the past.
Right.
So to cover those, you know, the basic weakness, and the goalkeeper is okay. He's doing quite well, actually, Stegenberg. But he doesn't inspire the same kind of confidence as Van der Sar, who was there for years. So to cover that, they're operating with two very defensive midfielders, Nigel de Jong and Mark van Bommel. And it's kind of dragging the whole team back. So the weight has somehow shifted. You've got six essentially defensive players, the fullbacks get forward a lot. And then it's the guys in front, so have license to be very creative and run around, but it's only the four of them.
Right.
And others join, but it's not, the idea has not been, you know, that the whole team is on the front foot. It's rather the reverse, and it's odd.
And right, and Kite, he's such a hustle guy. He's not really a guy who, you know, 95% of the time he does get the ball, you're not really expecting beauty from him.
No, he's not beautiful, but he's more effective than you think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was his run today for the goal that he set up for Snyder, second goal, the killer goal, was very clever, and his control on the head was very nice. And there was another time when he very delicately beat a guy on the wing and charged down like a proper winger. I mean, he was a very good spit centre forward for half a final before he went to Liverpool. He was known for his explosive, more like an English centre forward than a Dutch one, but a sort of explosive finisher. Rather dynamic player. Yeah, he's not a great kind of ball artist, but he's no dummy. So yeah, he's quite important to the team, actually. You know, his ethic, his sweating blood for the team. That's, you know, this time round, that's kind of important.
And of course, Snyder's just won every match he's played in probably for months going back now. I mean, he's had such a run with Inter Milan, and he's a highly confident player right now. It's good that Percy is fit. Van Persie is fit again.
Actually, I'll pull you up there because there's a little bit of a tension between those two. I was talking to a Dutch journalist today who's rather baffled as to why all these colleagues were talking about Van der Vaart and Snyder being the sort of two incompatible elements in the midfield. He's saying the problem is actually Snyder and Van Persie. They see space in a different way, and they don't actually play that well together.
Well, Van Persie was barking at the coach as he came off today.
Yeah, Van Persie is not having a good tournament so far, and he's getting, people in Holland are saying it's because he's not a natural centre forward. I don't think it's that. I think it's he's used to a different kind of movement around him. At Arsenal, it's relentless attack from every angle, and people switching positions and moving very fluidly. When he plays, I mean, Arsenal missed him very much this season because he was injured for 5 months. But it's not quite the same thing in the Holland team at the moment. It's Sneijder's passing doesn't kind of fit with Van Persie's sense of where he should be, and there's a little bit of tension there. I mean, they don't actually get on personally very well either. Snyder is a very difficult guy. Lots of people don't get on with him. He's also, it's quite interesting that he's completely gone native into Milan. You know, previously Dutch guys would go to Italy and they'd say, you know, this is a way to do it. And they'd order people around and be quite dominating. Even, you know, Brian Roy did it at Foggia a bit, and Ruud Krol at Napoli in the early 80s. Philip Van Basten and Rijkaard at Milan famously. Snyder's gone the other way. He said, yeah, no, this is good. I used to waste a lot of time trying to look cool. I'm just going to work completely for the team. He signed up totally for Mourinho's tactics and philosophy of the game. And he's even announced in an interview, I think at the end of last week, he's converted to Catholicism. He says the rosary every day on the phone with his incredibly glamorous girlfriend called Yolanta, something like that. I forget her name. She's staggeringly gorgeous.
Yes.
Dutch TV presenter. Anyway, he's gone completely Italian.
I want to go back to perhaps the most famous game in the history of Dutch football, which is the 1974 final. What's your interpretation of what happened in that game? Because for the first 3 minutes of the game, Germany didn't touch the ball, and Holland scored on a penalty kick, and it was the apex of a team that was mesmerizing the world. Yet, almost in the kind of tragic, dramatic sense, you know, the sort of flatter, less joyous forces won the match in Germany. So, just your reflections on that match.
Well, I've never got over it. I really have never got over it. You mention it. You mentioned the date. You mentioned it, and a little sort of wave of pain and regret came through me, and it always does every time I think of it. It's like the Kennedy assassination. It's a moment of a tragedy in the Greek drama sense. You can't say it another way. It plugs into all our romantic, as in romantic movement, ideas of, you know, what the ultimate tragic hero or right. the tragic figure. The one that moves us the most is the kind of the beauty struck down, the more beautiful, the more talented, the more the more unfair the ending, the more unexpected, or indeed suicide. That's no bar to iconic status. You know, Cobain is loved more than anybody else from that generation, and it's still a it's a pang. You can't think of Kurt Cobain without feeling a pang. It's the same with John Lennon. It's the same with, you know, Marilyn Monroe. It's slightly different, but it's, you know, Greta Garbo has got much greater status than Barbara Stanwyck. And Barbara Stanwyck was a much better actress. You know, but Garbo left the building. And that's what happened with the Dutch. They were the best, probably, possibly. I mean, people talk about the Hungarians of 53 and 54, the Pelé team, the Pelé Brazil of 1970. But along with those two, the Dutch of 1974 were simply the greatest team that's ever played. And you can, there are DVDs of their games through that tournament on sale. You can buy the whole set for like 100 euros. And it's a good watch. You know, it's still moving. It's still incredibly beautiful and stylish and funny and electrifying. Even though the pace of the game has changed, you adapt slightly, and it's amazing stuff. All through the tournament, they play the most fantastic football.
Oh. On YouTube, the Cruyff mashups are astonishing.
It is. It's thrilling stuff. My favorite one on YouTube is Holland Uruguay from the first game.
Yes.
And it's like 5 or 6 minutes. And they haven't just picked out the goals. They've picked out lots of little cameos and things like catching the Uruguayans, like 5, 6 Uruguayans at a time offside. There's a moment where Van Hanegem, who is he's the Feyenoord player, and he was slow moving, but very, very brilliant with his passing. I mean, astonishing passing, and a tough guy as well. And he's now a, I mean, he didn't really make it as a coach, but he's a much-loved TV sort of analyst and newspaper columnist on football. And there's a moment where the Uruguayans, who were being quite thuggish because there was no other way to stop the Dutch, somebody tried to sort of barge him over, and the guy just bounces off him and falls like a broken doll. And to compound the physical insult, he then... Van Hanegem backheels the ball to a colleague. So it's like complete contempt for this guy and total superiority. The whole tournament was like that. And then they start the game against the Germans, score without the Germans even touching the ball. And then hubris, the thing that leads to downfall and Greek tragedy, sets in. And because the history plays a part as well, this is, this is 30 years after the war. The war is fresh. For these historical reasons, as Brian Glanville put it, you know, historical reasons, they yearn to humiliate the Germans. And instead of going for another goal and finishing off the game, they taunt them, they make patterns, they just show off for the next 20, 25 minutes in the game. And the Germans were not to be trifled with. They were a fantastic side themselves, not quite as good as the Dutch. And they possessed in Franz Beckenbauer, probably the greatest defender of all time, one of, and then Gerd Müller, the greatest goal scorer of all time. And the Germans fought back and scored two goals. One of them a disputed penalty, which was probably, you know, it was fair enough to give. And it was 2-1 at half time. In the second half, the Dutch rallied, but they just couldn't score again. And in fact, the Germans scored again, the goal that was perfectly good, but was wrongly disallowed, Gerd Müller again. And they did it to themselves. And we now know from a book, ironically, entitled 1974, We Were the Best, which was a bit of a bestseller 6 years ago in Holland on the 30th anniversary. He went round every journalist called Alkekok, went round Holland and Germany and spoke to every eyewitness. People, there was an incident at the hotel that was reported. Naked German girls had been seen in the hotel swimming pool with frolicking with Dutch players. And the report of that was blamed. It appeared in Germany, and then it was said that this caused problems in the Dutch camp. And it was also said by Michels himself, the coach, that this was a German smear story, you know, that the German press were trying to destroy the Dutch when actually none of that was, the only thing that was true was the story itself. They were frolicking, and there was quite a lot of frolicking. The discipline had gone. They were living somewhat like rock stars in that hotel. And they thought they'd done the hard part by beating Brazil in the semifinal. Mm. And they just didn't prepare right. And the mentality, everything was wrong. And that's why they lost. And they've never got over it. That's a very long answer, but that's not my feelings.
I suppose to wrap up the conversation on Holland, there'll just be two more questions I have. The Brilliant Orange is the title of your book, David Winner. And then the subtitle includes the genius of Dutch soccer. Okay, we all see that, but the full subtitle is The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer. Explain neuroses and why you use that word.
Well, because you could almost say the pathology of pathological genius. I mean, it's dysfunctional. They have all this brilliance, but they also undermine it in all sorts of strange and interesting ways. I alluded to it earlier, but the history of Dutch self-inflicted defeats, 74 is the template, but it goes all the way through from then, and it's clearly neurotic.
The era that we're in now, in contrast to the 60s and 70s, sort of efficient technocratic management, Holland versus Brazil, both sides, according to your analysis of this year's Dutch team and what everybody has said about Dunga's Brazil, are trying to put the genius of their national soccer side somewhat dampen them, and in terms of the Dutch, dampen the neurotic and pathological sides for the purpose of efficiency and winning. What's your expectation for the match?
I'm fearful for Holland because Brazil looked very good. It could also be an extraordinary classic. You just don't know. The game that it looks most like going into it is the 94. They've met three times in the World Cup, and each time has been pretty interesting. 94 was the most cautious for the first half. Mm-hmm. Dutch were really in awe of Brazil, which they shouldn't have been, and didn't really dare come out. And then they suffered two quick goals against them, and then they just forgot all their tactics and just went for it and scored two quick goals, most fantastic comeback, and then the game was settled by a sort of disputed free kick and a long-range free kick by Branco that should have been saved probably. But it was a great, great second half. It was probably the best game, or one of the best games in that World Cup. And it could be the same again. I think if Holland can throw off their caution and play to their genius, which they have at least one authentic genius in Arjen Robben, now restored to fitness, and they have several support players who are almost as good, if they can play to that strength, they can trouble Brazil, I think. Brazil are very strong defensively, much stronger than Holland. I don't think it suits the Dutch to sit back and wait to be attacked. And you can't pick off Brazil in the way you can pick off Japan or Slovakia. They have to go for it a bit. Brazil, in the short time today that they were being pressed in the beginning of the game by Chile, they didn't look totally convincing. The problem was that Chile's attacks tended to sort of peter out, and these skillful players run into banks of Brazilian defenders instead of passing into space. Holland don't have to do that. And I thought Portugal pressed Brazil rather effectively the other day. So I think Holland's best form of defense is attack. Whether they'll do it, I don't know. I hope.
I often, because I suppose I'm a knee-jerk leftist, have rooted for sides sort of due to the political configurations of the societies at the time. One of the teams I, of course, rooted most passionately for was Holland against Argentina in 1978, which, of course, has a whole set of sub-stories to it. Holland these days, though, I think you're correct. The sort of political narrative that comes out of Holland is, while I don't believe that there's none of the major parties are undermining the welfare state, the sort of headlines that come out have to do with the sort of surprising reemergence from this, what was known of for the past few decades as an extremely liberal society, of a form of nativism.
Sure, that's absolutely what's happening. There's been a racist side to Holland, a dark side. That was, if you know your history about Holland, they were one of the big collaborator nations.
Right.
They've wanted to talk about during the war. Your chances as a Jew, for example, in Amsterdam were about twice as bad in Amsterdam as they were in France, where a lot of post-war soul-searching, and the police chiefs of Paris were rightly condemned and examined in great detail what they'd done. But the police chief in Amsterdam, a man called Sybrand Tulp, was much worse. So there is there's always been the Dutch are quite good at sort of self-promoting, and they haven't drawn attention to this. The current slightly darker sort of sense that you get out of Holland since Pim Fortuyn, really, on the other is in tune a bit with that. On the other hand, they would say that they are the defenders of precisely the kind of liberalism
right. That
you warm to. In that, you know, Pim Fortuyn said, you know, I'm not racist. I'm not against anybody. But I just don't like this very intolerant brand of Islam that's coming into Holland, and it's not compatible with our values. And I'm a gay man, and I don't want us to have to go through all the battles we went through in the 50s and 60s, 70s to win equal rights and so on. We don't want to have to do all that again with Islam.
Right. It's a stunningly out of tune out of tune argument.
Look, but, it's not just you know, nativist. It's not like a Jörg Haider phenomenon.
Right.
Because, I mean, even Geert Wilders is not an attractive party, and he's not an attractive personality, but he doesn't say, you know, sort of classic racist things at all. He pitches it all in terms of, I am defending the liberal freedoms that we've had, and multiculturalism isn't what we thought it was going to be. It's produced these problems, and that's actually a problem it's a discussion, let's say, one is entitled to have across, you know, the Western world, probably. How does one deal with all this? And because mainstream parties have tended to not want to have that conversation, partly because of that you're having this, but there isn't, absolutely, there's an activist and rather unpleasant and distinctly racist aspect to it as well.
Well, one of the peculiarities, especially in the 1980s when I was a student at university, and there was a huge, you know, anti-apartheid movement across the world, as you know, you'd look at Holland and see at that point, you know, this sort of unwaveringly liberal society. And then you'd look down to South Africa and you had the descendants of the Dutch making up the balance of the most virulent defenders of apartheid. And so this World Cup is taking place in South Africa. And, you know, it's all subtextual, but it's something of an odd fit.
Well, there's also you could point to the very brutal colonial war that the Dutch fought in Indonesia after they'd been occupied themselves. It's not a pretty story.
Right.
No, I mean, there it is. The Dutch aren't as adorable as, you know, they are adorable. I love them very dearly. I mean, it's often said, for example, about Anne Frank, you know, that she's actually, she's not Dutch, she's German, and she's betrayed by the Dutch. By several Dutch people, which is a bit like the thing they say about Germany and Austria after the war. Austrians managed to persuade everybody that Beethoven was Austrian and Hitler was German. Whereas actually, it was the other way around.
Right. Well, and they put the capital in Bonn after the war because what positive national symbol could they come up with except Beethoven? You mentioned Anne Frank, and I want to move on to talk just briefly about the British national side before we let you go. But in mentioning Anne Frank...
What's the connection between Anne Frank and the English side?
Oh, no. Anne Frank relates, though, to Johan Cruyff in this manner, which is that if you think about Johan Cruyff and then later Van Basten, but particularly Cruyff now, okay, Anne Frank, Rembrandt, Van Gogh are probably the three Dutch people who would come to mind at least first for somebody who goes through an American high school education as being the most famous Dutch people from history. You probably haven't heard much about Spinoza, right? In the world, and I think this is something that is lost on Americans, that Johan Cruyff is probably the most famous and almost certainly the most celebrated post-war Dutch person. Am I correct in that?
Absolutely. And he's the most important Dutch person for the Dutch. No question about it. I've tried to persuade the Dutch foreign ministry, for example. I said, you know, you are crazy. They promote their culture through people like Rem Koolhaas, the architect, and Harry Mulisch, the writer, and other people that almost nobody's heard of. And I say, you are nuts. You should do what the Brazilians have done with Pelé and what the Germans did with Beckenbauer and what the English have done more recently with David Beckham. You know, your footballers are the most fantastic advertisement for your country. You couldn't buy it. You know, they define the country in the most lovely way. And you should be showering attention on these guys and promoting them and so on. And I mean, some of the 70s guys who are my heroes, Cruyff is very well known and very successful and so on, but some of them, you know, they live quite in a modest way and they've largely been forgotten, people like Rentenbrink and Johnny Rep. You know, they're still great guys.
And really, they came a crossbar away from winning the title, the World Cup, in South America. They would be the only European side to have won out of Europe, and they were doing it without Cruyff, who at the time at least, declared that he would not go to play in Argentina because there was a fascist dictatorship there. And
that was never the case, by the way, because he announced right after the 74 tournament, when there was no dirty war, there was no, nobody knew the name of Videla, and there was no junta, there was no campaign of mass torture and mass killing, there was no death, not death camp exactly, but the mechanics school, which is as close to the main stadium where the final was in Buenos Aires as Wembley Park tube station is from Wembley Stadium in London, within screaming distance, this place where people were systematically tortured to death, thousands of them, including during the tournament. None of that was happening, and none of that was even known to be in the future. And even then, Cruyff said he wouldn't go. People, we don't know. He claims it's because his family was held by robbers at Knife Point
in Barcelona.
I forget, in Barcelona, and that's why he didn't go. But nobody really knows for sure. It could be, you know, this sort of the residue of the swimming pool incident in 74. That's the common theory.
But still, it's a nice political gesture.
They did come very, very. I mean, what I now know about the 78 tournament, I mean, it should never have been played. It was a terrible thing, and it because of the Argentine junta kind of influenced events on the field. Let's put it like that. And there's lots of instances of cheating and unsavory behaviour, and you know, and it ended up with Argentina winning, and the euphoria that produced in the country kept the junta in power for another 4 years. A lot of people died because of that World Cup. But having said all that, yes, Holland came within a millimetre of winning the game with the last kick almost when Rensenbrink hit the post. And then in the second half, in extra time, the Argentines came out and scored another two goals in a very, very strange game. And nobody's explained how the Argentines, who looked dead at the end of 90 minutes, suddenly came out supercharged for extra time. It was all very peculiar, and they were doing horrible things. They were catching the ball and cheating, and it was just an awful, awful final.
And Maradona was already a sensation, not included in the side, and of course would redeem Argentine football in 86. But you wrote a book after you wrote Brilliant Orange called Those Feet, A Sensual History of English Football. And your book on Dutch soccer is so exceptional and so sublime, and you have the turf there in many respects to yourself in the manner of the book, at least in English. Of course, trying to write books on when one writes a book about English football, there's libraries full of books on English football. And British national side this year, I could not possibly believe that a team from England made up of stars from the Premiership could be that bad. I mean, they were.
I have to correct you. It's not the British national side.
Sorry, yes.
Scotland, Ireland, and Wales would get very pissed off about that.
Yes. David Winter, you followed up Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer, with another work on football, Those Feet, A Sensual History of English Football. I'm guessing from your accent that you are an English national. The 2010 World Cup has to go down as a nadir in the history of English football. I mean, I think they really performed better in the 2008 Euro Championship, which they didn't qualify for, than they did in the 2010 World Cup. That was really horrible. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I was. Everybody in England has been trying to kind of work out how bad that was. You should understand that we have developed over the decades of underachievement. It starts a long way back. It starts in 1953 when England lose for the first time to a foreign team on English soil for the Hungarians. And so it's the defining moment of English football. And then it's sort of the lesson of that game was that the insular, arrogant, blinkered England had been taught a great lesson by innovators on the continent as we put it, you know, the Europeans had come and shown that they'd learned football and they'd learned to play it better than we did ourselves. And that was a great shock, and we solemnly affirmed that we would never be caught in this way again, and we would learn, and never happened. And time and again over the last, well, since 1953, English teams have come a cropper in precisely the same way as they did this time. And it's bewildering, really, that a pattern can repeat itself so persistently. The gulf between what they should have been and what they were was particularly odd this time. See players, I mean, we know that Gerrard and Lampard don't play that well together, but see Rooney lumbering around like a lost sheep. Mm-hmm. It's just strange. He's a lion to Manchester United, and there he was, just, you know, he'd look happier on a Welsh hillside, really. He looked very unhappy. It was inept. It was embarrassing. It was very odd. And I think by now it's become a problem of the way that we in England approach the national team. You know, we burden it with all the expectations and all the anxieties that come from it being sort of, it's our ersatz lost empire. We've never talked about the loss of empire as a national trauma, which it clearly was, but we talked about it instead through sport, primarily football, primarily soccer, and the failure of the national team to do much after winning the World Cup in 1966, which was a redemption for 1953, and losing to the Americans also in 1950, though that was barely noticed at the time. But the decline since 66 became tied up with the sense that England had fallen as a great power. And so now and it's very strange being in Italy and following the English coverage, it accentuates something I've already known and I write about in those feeds, about how we imbue football with a whole language of military metaphors and national pride and national virility and national masculinity, without getting anywhere near, you know, gender studies or something, which I don't like. But that's the kind of stuff that's going on. So it's all about battle and a famous, slightly hammy, very hammy actually, but sort of lovable old actor called Brian Blessed was on the BBC coverage. I was watching the BBC coverage in an Italian pub, mm-hmm. which is even strange. And he was reciting before the game what was the speech from Henry V? Mm. God for Harry, England and St. George. And it was just kind of, this doesn't work in World Cup. You know, you should be talking about technicalities of football, about not just sort of charge and get into them, and Fabio Capello's troops, you know, that would be another one. I think that's part of the problem, because the players shrivel somehow. They're big egos, they're arrogant and so on, but then they feel the weight of all this expectation. And it, as Fabio Capello says, you know, the shirt has become very heavy. And they put it on, and they played with no confidence. They looked like they'd just been introduced to each other 10 minutes before kickoff. It's horrible.
Yeah, I think as time passes, I mean, a lot will hinge on Rooney, but there was almost nothing there from anybody. And the main thing,
many times the defending again, because it plugs into the war and it's the Germans. It was quite witty today. Richard Littlejohn in the Daily Mail said, you know, if the few, it's a reference to the Battle of Britain, won by the few, the Spitfire pilots and so on. So if the few had defended like this against Germany, we'd all be speaking German now.
Yeah.
But again, you know, cast it in terms of the war and lost pride and the English chant, two world wars, one world cup. You know, it's like embarrassing now.
Yeah, it was.
Germany is not. It's not the Germany even of post-war. It's a very different Germany. And please don't go on about it. It doesn't help them or us, or it particularly doesn't help us.
Looking at the rest of the tournament before we let you go, first off, Argentina-Germany. Your thoughts on Diego Maradona's Argentina?
They're very good, aren't they? Mm. They haven't really been put under pressure yet. Last World Cup, I went round the world watching people watch the World Cup who because I thought, well, you know, the event is a television event. It doesn't really matter what happens in the stadium. That people in there are like the TV audience in a studio, and the real show, the real cultural meat of the thing, real event is millions, countless millions of people watching in pubs and piazzas and, you know, great public spaces and private homes on all around the planet. And that's, I ended up in Buenos Aires on my round the world thing, watching Germany, Argentina in a bar in Buenos Aires, like an hour after I got off the plane. I formed an unexpected deep bond. Not that deep, actually, but I mean, it's an unexpectedly deep bond and deep sense of affection for Argentina and the pain of the people who were watching that afternoon. It was very moving. I felt their pain and their joy, and I kind of rooting for Argentina a bit this time. I mean, Maradona, he's a hate figure for a lot of English people. They remember the infamous hand of God.
Oh, sure.
About which too much has been said. And
redemption for the Falklands War, too, in one football match.
We don't care about that. We absolutely don't care about that.
Well, they cared a little bit down there. But again, they knocked out the fascist dictatorship. So,
but in mainland England, we really didn't care. We only talk about the hand of God, and we mock him for his drug taking and his madness and all that. But there's something about him that you can't help but love.
Oh, doesn't a person like that and Cruyff, they're possessed of real human genius.
Total genius. And you can't expect a genius to be, you know, well balanced. It just doesn't go with the territory, does it?
No.
I mean, he's very extreme. Pelé, and he probably deserved to be considered equal. Pelé is much the more sort of amiable. Well, there's no comparison. He's an amiable, sweet. Everybody likes him. But he's much less interesting, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, again, I've been bantering around the idea of a Faustian pact with Diego Maradona, especially after they were so wretched in qualifying. And now all of a sudden, here's this team which had no cohesion, 100-plus players tried on the squad during qualifying. Now they're totally cohesive. The exclusions seem to have helped in terms of team unity, leaving off, you know, Cambiaso, Zanetti after they win the European Championship. Of course, Riquelme's long gone. Melito's on the bench versus Higuain, which doesn't seem to make
after the season he had.
But I've now posited the notion that he's not Faust, but he's the Lord of the Underworld himself.
he is Sauron, Lord of Mordor, isn't he?
What do you make of Germany, though? Because that team has great skill and speed and the athleticism as always.
Delightful. I mean, it's, again, a confounding of all the old stereotypes about the efficient Teutonic, you know, tedious oppression of German teams, playing just delicious, attacking, beautifully balanced, clever football, and there are hardly any Germans in the team.
Yes, that's true.
The best player is a Turk, and it's very cool. And Joachim Löw is a sort of cool metrosexual guy. He's, you know, you couldn't get further from Sepp Herberger, the architect of the post-war German ethos in football, the guy who steers the 54 team to unexpected victory against the Hungarians, who is the font of, with, you know, things like the ball is round, the next game is the most important, all these kind of workmanlike, but, you know, quite effective philosophical aphorisms about football. They're all from him. And Löw is just a different character, a different image altogether. It's, again, looking from a Dutch perspective, it's kind of weird that the Germans are now playing the attractive modern football and the Dutch playing this rather cool, calculating percentage-type football. But I think in the Dutch case, it's more just, you know, a desperate attempt to overcome past traumas than anything else. No, I mean, I like the Germans very much. They were so superior against England. The over the line goal wasn't really here or there, most people think.
Right.
Yeah, no, they're great.
And last country I'll ask you about, because obviously here in the United States, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but the popularity of the World Cup on television, I think, is like 60% up, depending on how you cut, slice and dice it, and you mix in the Spanish language television viewership plus the English language, it's maybe doubling previous World Cups. The team played a set of dramatic games. What do you make of this year's Team USA, and what's your sense from where you sit, obviously as a preeminent soccer historian and sort of cultural analyst of global soccer? What do you make of soccer or football, as it were, in the USA right now?
I happened to be in New York during the 1990 World Cup, watching Spanish channel, Univision. Mm-hmm. Univision. Is it still going? I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
And Andres Cantor was the commentator, wasn't he?
Yes. From a studio in Miami, I think.
From a studio in Miami, sure, or LA or where it was. Mm-hmm. But he certainly wasn't in Italy watching the games, but it was great. But I felt the loneliest man in the universe, because there's a couple of Egyptian guys down the road in a pizza place, and we bonded like brothers because we were the only people we knew in New York who cared about soccer and the World Cup. And I remember very vividly watching the England-Germany semi-final that year, which was a fantastic, emotional, amazing game. It was also July 4th. And my friends kept sort of bothering me all through the second half and extra time and penalties. They're like, come on, we could go to the party. I think you don't understand. This is one of the most important days in world history, certainly in my life. But, there was no comprehension at all of what a World Cup was. There must have been a few isolated pockets of people like me in the city. It's now completely transformed. You can have a conversation with pretty much any American. People, friends are in New York, in LA, all over the States, who know a good deal about football. We still call it soccer, but it's a complete transformation. And I was watching the Slovenia-US game in a bar in Rome, which was full of young Americans. Mm. And it was a fantastic atmosphere, and they completely got everything. And when the equalizer came, it was USA, USA. It was great. And then they were as upset as any other fans would be when the winning goal was stolen from them at the end. And even afterwards, you could see people in the team shirts walking around in the center of Rome. And I chatted with some of them, and it's exactly as it would have been with any other soccer fan from anywhere in the world. So it's completely, America has joined the rest of the world on increasingly equal terms, because the Team USA was pretty good. On the other hand, it also lacked that thing that makes difference between a sort of competent, efficient, serviceable kind of team and proper quality team that's going to win things and win hearts. There just wasn't enough creativity when it came to it against Ghana. I think that was the problem, that you don't have the kind of creative players that the Brazilians, the Argentines, the Dutch, and a few other nations have, who've just simply been playing the game longer and have developed it. There's also this thing I remember when I was trying to get Brilliant Orange published in the States. I was looking at a lot of books being written in the States, and a lot of them seemed to be completely missing the point. There'd be kind of 50 restart plays by such and such a coach. Mm. Or you'd pick out something, which was the way you would approach, I guess, American football. But it most certainly doesn't work. You just can't do that with soccer. And if you start trying to do it, it means you've missed the point somehow. Mm-hmm. But it's a much more fluid thing. And it's actually quite hard to define. It's almost impossible. It's pointless, actually, to kind of restart plays. I mean, you can have strategies for corners, free kicks, and so on. But that's not what the game is about. So that I was struck by. But that's like a cultural thing. You come from a different background. Mm-hmm. The Japanese also, for example, have sort of some cultural baggage which stops them playing soccer as effectively as they probably will do in another few years. Namely, the sort of samurai, post-samurai thing where it's considered a bit shameful. This is weird. A bit shameful to shoot, to sort of be selfish enough to want to hog the glory of actually scoring a goal. So the Japanese technical play is very good, but they don't score enough goals. It's in the J League, it's a lot of foreigners who score most of the goals. That's weird. I think you'd agree. But they'll get over that. And America will be producing players who are less fixated and coaches who are less fixated with the sort of athletic and planable, if that's a word, aspects of the game. It'll be more fluid, and you'll get into the the more sort of spontaneous sort of sensing of patterns, and passing is a set of relationships that sort of build on a field, and it's very fluid. It's quite hard to define, but you sort of, it's a bit like the offside rules. There's a nice German film about the offside, called Offside, and at the end it's sort of like a sort of bend it like Beckham story, and at the end you understand why it's called Offside. The filmmaker asks people in the streets to define the offside rule, and none of them can really do it. So somebody says, it's like love. It's very hard to explain, but you know it when you see it. Soccer is a bit like that, but you kind of, there's a certain point where you just get it. You think, it should be like that, and that's in the wrong position, because you can't necessarily put it into words, you just feel it. And that's a feeling that the older soccer countries have. And you will acquire it, and you're developing at a phenomenal rate. And, it's still a minority sport, I know, but it's a very large minority, and there's more people playing soccer than live in the Netherlands, in the States. You've got a fair old momentum going, I think. And Team USA, if that's the correct way to call it, will get better and better, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, according to Simon Cooper from the Financial Times, there are more organized youth soccer players in the United States than any country in the world. And by the way, I have to let you go. I know it's late there, and we're sort of on to global football. Have you ever traveled to India and looked at football culture there? We're going to do a little research on this in the next few days. Maybe I'll bracket this and not include this in the interview, but have you ever gone there, and how popular is football in India?
I've never been there, and I don't know, but I did some research on this a while back and discovered that the biggest local derby game anywhere in the world is in India, and I forget even which cities it's in, but it's two teams you've never heard of, and they play in front of like 130,000 people, crazy with passion. It's not the major sport. It's not like cricket.
Right.
But like everywhere else, it's, they see, the global television is changing everything.
Right.
And football becomes the global language in a way that we've never seen since silent cinema. It's football, soccer is much bigger now than pop music, rock, or whatever, popular music, which is very, different in each country. Though we, in America and England, we tend to think it's not, but in a country like Italy, for example, it doesn't penetrate all. I mean, there's a huge local thing, and it is all over the world, but soccer, global language, it's completely, it's as close to being universal as we've had.
Right.
It cuts across language, culture, climate, cuts across everything, and right. It's completely, it's one of the things I sort of knew already, but I didn't know it until I saw it, that people in completely different countries all understand this language in identical way, but there are different styles, but actually they're less important than you think they're going to be, and it's like, it's as if you enter a different space when a game comes on, especially World Cup game that everybody's watching. You suddenly all speak the same language because you're all following the same thing and you know what it means. Somehow encodes very deep rituals and meanings that are very, very deep in humanity. And it can't be an accident that soccer, more than any other sport, has come to dominate the world in the way that it does. Without being a kind of, I mean, even though FIFA is totally obnoxious and corrupt and all the rest, even people like Sepp Blatter can't ruin football. It's amazing. And it keeps growing.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with them. One of the things I really hate is the FIFA World Cup, FIFA TM, FIFA World Cup TM, and they're trying to brand everything in this very unsavory, megalomaniac, actually, thing with the orange-clad Dutch girls who are promoting a Bavaria beer instead of the official beer. And they ended up in jail, in a court. It was mad. So I'm not a big fan of FIFA in all sorts of ways, but they cannot sort of disrupt the essential magic of the thing, which is that everybody can play it, everybody understands it. It's very simple but very profound somehow. Can get very complicated, but it's very simple. It is a global language. We're in new territory here, and we all need to kind of speak the language a bit. And at the same time, it's kind of a little bit worrying that people only talk about football and lose sight of other things, and it has a bit of a squashing effect around the world as well. Mm-hmm. And that's not so good. But it's very powerful, and I'm surprised that other people, I'm surprised there are not more academics and not more intellectuals sort of really getting interested in it. It is interesting.
Actually, here in the United States, both at a local university here in the Pomona College Group, there were two professors who had a global football course, and at Duke University in North Carolina, Laurent Dubois had a World Cup and World Politics course. The course at the Pomona Colleges was the most popular course, I was told, ever. I'm not sure if that's accurate, but at least in recent memory at the university. It's interesting, too, because the sort of geopolitics of soccer, which in a sense you hinted at in this sort of squashing effect you mentioned, it is somewhat inverted here, because I've made this argument consistently throughout this show, that in the United States, anything that brings global football to the United States has, I can dream of whatever kind of nicer, socialist economy that I'd like to see occur, nice humanist socialism, participatory democratic socialism, nothing nasty there. In the States, on a much simpler plane, you have the right-wing Fox News railing against football, because it's unmanly, it's un-American. What else are they saying? Socialist. They're saying it's socialist, which is, of course, ridiculous. But it's this red state, blue state divide. And, of course, it is along sort of an internationalist of the internationalists of the blue states, right? The people who got into Obama for the notion of a hope and change that was not the Bush administration, versus the Sarah Palins and the Bushes who are invested for their, political future for this kind of insulated nativism that then becomes about, baseball, basketball, football, and the exclusion of soccer. So, the entry into the global community and the global language of soccer has this clear, and by the way, I think Fox News is basically right. They do have to fear this, at least in the context of the United States, that this is, as the imperial hegemon, when we go out and we blitz and we kill people, that's predicated on their dehumanization, and global football, is going to not allow that.
It's interesting that it can be. That was news to me, actually. I'd sort of picked it up slightly that there was on the comedian circuit. There's a slight argument going on in America about soccer, which again is new, and it's an indication that it's growing, because it used to be just barely registered. Even when it was in the States, when the World Cup was actually staged in America, it didn't impact that much. Now it's been transformed. And I remember, I think it's probably a famous article by somebody, can't remember the name, but it's somebody noted a few years ago about the vast amounts of money that baseball and American football had spent trying to kind of promote themselves around the world, and instead, without a huge amount of and the World Cup and FIFA marketing and other people have been trying to market soccer in the other direction, but the weight was very much on traditional American sports. And in fact, what had happened was that soccer had come to America, and lots of people had taken it up, and people were going to bars and wearing shirts, especially at World Cup time. And that was unexpected, but it demonstrates the thing I was saying earlier, that the very simplicity of it, and the way that it's not complicated. There are a few statistics, but they're not that interesting, not that important. It's not a numbers game in the way that some American sports are. It's just really straightforward, really primal. At the same time, it's hard to stop. And if I was American, I would be a bit upset about it. I'm not very nostalgic. For example, baseball, I think is a wonderful game. It's got, it does have all these deep rhythms and subtleties and things, like cricket as well, which, it's a nice distinction between America and England, but we just basically don't get each other's bat and ball games. But they're very deep, and they're very beautiful, and it would be a shame, as happened in the West Indies, in Jamaica and Barbados and places like that, which used to have, you know, basically it was a cricket culture, and soccer and basketball have come in and hugely diminished it. Is that a good thing? I'm not sure it is, really. I like more the merrier, more different approaches the merrier. I mean, maybe Japan should not take up soccer. Maybe it should stick with, you know, sumo and stuff. And it's nice that other people do different things. So in some ways, it's a flattening. The globalization, the fact that everybody's going to be watching the same thing is a bit sad.
Well, you know, if...
Two different things. And it's very interesting. In Iran, for example, it's said that after the 98 World Cup, when Iran beat America, beat USA and France, the regime in Tehran took that, you know, they were expecting one thing, that it was going to be a bit of a propaganda thing. But what actually happened was that there was fraternization and warmth between the Iranian and U.S. soccer players. That was one thing, and the spectators as well. And they made quite sure that they didn't qualify for the next one or for this one. It is said that the regime doesn't want there to be, you know, that soccer has a humanizing, exactly what you were saying earlier. It's very hard to hate in a sort of Orwellian Friday prayers in are there Friday prayers in Tehran or in, yeah, they're in Tehran, aren't they, in Qum. You know, that's kind of very, very, very scary stuff, and soccer is a kind of threat to that. It's soccer is aligned there with the Green Revolution, and the national team played, you know, the stolen election last year, the soccer team, the national team, somebody was playing with green armbands the next day, and then we didn't see those players anymore. And so soccer became one of the vehicles for that voice that was being repressed everywhere else. You know, it became, we'll know eventually when the regime falls just how important it was, as it was in South Africa, indeed. Mm-hmm. Soccer was terribly important.
And the Iraq team winning the Asian championship,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it would be very interesting to know, because, you know, a lot was written about the surge, and the two sort of coincided, but the surge wasn't doing terribly well until after Iraq won that championship. It would really be interesting to know what effect that had. I mean, again, we won't know properly for years. I mean, some of people will write about it eventually. But I was very struck by that. Yeah, 2007.
Well, it's been great having you here on The People's Game, David Winner. David Winner is the author of Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer, as well as Those Feet, A Sensual History of English Football. David Winner, thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game.
My pleasure.